time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Tarun Teshpal. Tarun Teshpal is a journalist, publisher, and novelist. In his 28-year career, he has been an editor with India Today and the India Express Groups, and the managing editor of Outlook, India's premier news magazine. In March 2000, he co-founded Tehelka, a news organization that has earned a global reputation for its aggressive public interest journalism, and where he remains editor-in-chief and publisher. He is author of The Alchemy of Desire, and he is here to talk about his new book, The Story of My Assassins. Tarun Teshpal, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Pleasure to be here.
So start out, tell us, what was the motivation in writing The Story of My Assassins?
You know, well, the book came to me at a time when I was going through a very difficult phase in my life. We had done a huge expose on corruption in arms procurements in India. It had led to the resignation of the Defense Minister of India and the resignation of the President of the ruling party, and the government had almost collapsed. But post that, the government had hit back very, very viciously at us, and which led to our closure for almost three and a half years. And about that time, which was, I think, we broke the story in March 2001, and in May 2001, my doorbell rang one morning, and I opened the door, and there was a policeman standing outside. And I asked him what he wanted, and he said he was there to guard me. So I gave him a chair outside the door, and he sat down on the chair, and he had a 9mm revolver tucked into his pants. And every time I would step out, he would follow me around. And 3 days later, the bell again rang early in the morning. I opened the door, and there was a sub-inspector of police standing outside. And I asked him what he wanted, and he said, "We've decided you need more guards." So he posted another 3 guys with carbines and revolvers. And every time I stepped out, these cops would follow me around. And then a few days later, it was a Sunday morning, and I'd gone into office to send some emails. And I was sitting in office sending my emails, 10 o'clock in the morning, and my phone rang, my mobile, and I picked it up, and it was a friend of mine from Bombay. And he said, "Are you alive?" There was a question mark at the end of the sentence. And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Turn on the television set." I turned on the television set, and there was breaking news on every single channel that a murder attempt on Tarun Teshpal had been foiled. And what the news did not say was actually that the hit had never taken place. I think the Delhi police had issued a press release saying an attempt had been foiled and 5 hitmen had been captured. And within the next hour or so, I received hundreds of phone calls from across the country. So that was that. And a few days later, the complement of police guarding me just went up dramatically. I had about 24 armed policemen guarding me 24 hours a day. My house was sandbagged. My office was sandbagged. I couldn't even travel in my own car with my daughters and wife. There used to be a carbine-wielding policeman sitting in front, one man with a 9mm pistol at the back. There was an escort car full of carbine-wielding policemen. Wherever I went in India, they picked me up from the airport, a police complement, and took me around. And the story that I was told about these hitmen went something like this. They said to me, the police, that the ISI of Pakistan, which is the undercover agency of Pakistan, the ISI of Pakistan had taken out a contract on my life, which was given in Kathmandu, Nepal, to 5 Indian hitmen. And the rationale ran somewhat like this, that if something happened to me, if there was a hit on me and something happened to me, the government of the day, with whom I was having this kind of power public battle, would have to take the rap and might fall. So it would lead to political unrest in India. So this was what was told to me. There was no way of ascertaining the truth, you know, because I do believe, as a journalist of 30 years standing and at that point of 20 years standing, with a lot of proximity to power, that fundamentally the heart of power is very opaque and unknowable. You really don't know what's happening in there. And that's true of all cultures, all nations, all civilizations. So beyond a point, I didn't even pursue the inquiry about what was it really about. Who were these 5 hitmen and what was it really about and what was the story? A couple of months after the incident, by which time I was living in an absolute garrison of armed policemen, I was summoned to the lower courts in Delhi. I went to the lower court. And the lower courts in India, you know, since then I've always said that if you haven't been to a lower court in India, you have no idea about Indian democracy. You have to visit a lower court to begin to understand the true nature of Indian democracy and how complex it is. So I was summoned to the lower court for an identification parade. And I went there, and the magistrate trotted out these five hitmen, and he asked me one by one if I could, I knew any of them, and of course I didn't. So I, it was just a, and this is one of the seed sequences in the book which I came to write. But it was when I left the courtroom, which was a really surreal experience. When I left the courtroom, the whole literary side of me kicked in, and this conceit of exploring a narrative on the story of my killers, the story of my assassins, began to brew inside my head. And the first exploratory note that struck me in my head was, what is it that brings a man to a point where he's willing to take a few rupees and murder a man he knows nothing about, you know? And so what was the journey that these boys had taken to have reached a point where they were willing to take money and take a hit on me who they knew nothing about? And that began to sort of slowly brew in my head. But it took me a long time to actually begin the writing of the book, almost 4 years, because the material inside my head kept growing, and it became larger and larger, and it then became almost an inquiry, an examination into the nature of Indian democracy, the plight of the underclass in India, the complexity of spirituality in India, and the nature of power. So it became many, many different themes. So those who read the book now, and I have to say that it's been very gratifying in this book tour that I've done to see almost all the major publications in both UK and America responding very, very strongly to the book. Because it's a very polyphonous book. It's a book peopled by many characters, many voices. It became many things. But I had a problem. I couldn't get into the book. I couldn't find the voice with which to write the book. And it's only when I found the voice of the voice of the narrator is highly dyspeptic. He's a very acidic, acerbic kind of narrator. He's actually a very dislikable guy. It's only when I found that highly dislikable voice that the material began to open itself up, and I could start writing. And this was almost 4 years after the book had come to me. And then, of course, I wrote it without pause, because that voice, that very dyspeptic voice, just opened up the whole material to me. And I ended up writing and talking about not just the mystery of the killers and why they wish to kill, the complex mystery of that, but also it allowed me, that whole framework, to actually talk a lot about pressing Indian issues, which I feel very strongly about.
And is that why you made it a novel rather than, let's say, a memoir or nonfiction?
You know, the thing about I do journalism on a daily basis. That is my day job. So journalistically, I deal with these issues as best as it's possible to do in fact and in journalism. But you know, literary fiction has a completely different magic to it. I mean, it can create a kind of universe and potentialities that non-fiction cannot. I mean, that's the beauty of literary fiction. It can excavate souls. It can excavate emotion. You know, it can excavate the kind of almost nuanced things of the business of life that fundamentally journalism can't, and even memoir struggles to do it. I also didn't want to write a memoir because I didn't want to write a story about myself. I was pretty clear, even when I was going through this great, great battle with the state, that the issue was not me. The issue was the issues I'd raised. So fundamentally, I needed the material to be outside of me, you know, and I wanted to deal with that. Writing a memoir would have meant being fundamentally obsessed with my story. The story of my assassins is only very, very partially my story, in the sense that the material comes from my life. But it is a story imagined. It is a story about really the assassins, the killers. And in India, you know, the problem is the Indian elite inhabits we are a very class-divided society. I mean, the Indian elite, which is the English-speaking elite, inhabits a completely removed world from everybody else, even though we live cheek by jowl. The stories of the underclass, of whom I would say we have 900 million, you know, the stories of the underclass actually remain untold, at least in the English language. So while there has been this great boom of English writers in English, from India around the world, the truth is that those stories have not been told. Indian writers in English have been telling a kind of story of their own class. I was very, very fixated on trying to excavate the stories of this, these untold stories of the underclass, and to somehow bestow a kind of dignity on them. You know, we have almost 600 to 700 million people in India who live at sub-Saharan poverty levels. There's great deprivation, you know. So what I really did with the story of my assassins is that I actually took There are five assassins, and these stories were imagined but drawn from my own life and experience and people I've known or read about. So the five assassins, in a sense, came to exemplify the great fault lines of India: caste, religion, language, feudalism, sectarian conflict. So all the great fault lines that run through India and create conflict in India, they all came to represent these fault lines, all the five assassins. And it's interesting to see that different readers and critics have loved different assassins. What is gratifying to see, which was a kind of a conceit that I was pursuing in the book, that I wanted to see whether in the writing of the book, my reader would be somewhere at least ambiguous, if not convinced, that the assassins were no less likable or dislikable than the man they wanted to kill, or their moralities were no less robust or more robust than the man they wanted to kill. And I also wanted to... So what I did in the writing of the book was I took each assassin back to his childhood. I told the backstory of all the five assassins. And that did something very interesting, because when you take somebody back to their childhood, then you restore them to the age of innocence. And so before the world happens to you, we are all innocent. And so in the telling of the stories from the time they were children, I was able to establish that perhaps before they began to wrong the world, they had been wronged by the world. So they were probably more wrong than wronging. And that's the kind of thing, you know, for a literary novelist, it's a very exciting line of inquiry to pursue. And so I fleshed out the stories of these five assassins, and you know, two of the assassins live under the railway station in New Delhi. One is a feudal victim and a wielder of a knife as his chosen weapon of killing. One owes fealty to a big dacoit, a political dacoit, and he uses a long-stemmed hammer to kill. So he's called the brain curry man. And all these were drawn from things I'd read about or known in my life, all my characters. And the last one is a Muslim boy, a young boy who's devastated and destroyed by the English language, because he has no means of coping with it. And so I looked at five very, very different assassins, very different backgrounds, and then tried to, one, construct the story, and then try to bring the whole plot into a kind of coherence, that even through the great opacity, there was a kind of coherence. And at the end of the coherence, there were still questions, which is really how life very often ends up being. You know, we answer many questions, and when we finish answering those questions, we find we are faced with a whole set of new ones. So in a sense, the writing of the book was a very, very gratifying act for me, because I thought I was dealing with such difficult material, to put it together in a virtually a murder plot, you know, that was a challenge. So I have to say, no matter what the book does in the world, it's the best book I could have written on the subject I went to try to write on.
Did you ever find out the true story on where the assassins had come from?
It was impossible to do that, you know. It was impossible to do that. What I do know today is that one of the assassins is dead, and the other four are out on bail now, this 11 years later. The man who took the contract is a very, very famous guy from the eastern part of India. He's a mafia don and a bit of a political leader. And he's actually is also arraigned in court on the murder case for having taken the contract. But, you know, it's really impossible to tell beyond a point, because, as I said, you know, power has a kind of miasma around it, and you can't penetrate that miasma beyond a point. But for me, what was exciting was that the whole thing allowed me a framework to enter and tell a very, very complex story in a compelling way, in a page-turning way.
Tell us about the fallout from the original Operation West End.
Well, what really happened after that was, you know, one, of course, was we became national heroes. So everybody from the bus driver on the road to the high and mighty of India knew of us, and we got a lot of accolades for the work we'd done. But the other thing was the government just hit back in a very extra constitutional way, the government of the day, and we were pretty much shut down. We had dozens of false cases put against us. Three of my colleagues were arrested on trumped up cases. Our investors were hounded. We were locked into a really dubious commission of inquiry that ate up 19 months of our life. So there was all this stuff happening, and we did no journalism for close to 4 years. We just fought this very public battle, and there weren't too many of us. There were just one or two of us fighting this public battle. So in a way, I used to be on national television every single day taking on, and they were just accusing us of all kinds of dubious things. Everything was a lie. Every single agency of the government was unleashed against us, income tax, IRS, the police, you know, I mean, the IB, everything, to just get any dirt on us. It's just lucky that, I mean, our cupboards, they tooth combed our professional and personal lives. We were just fortunate that they actually never found anything on us, you know, otherwise they would have really cleaned us up. The other thing that helped was, it wasn't that easy for them to run me down beyond a point, because I come from the same elite class that my tormentors came from. You know, had it been somebody else who done that story, they might have just wiped them out. You know, but I've been to the same schools and colleges, and I come from the same social class. You know, it's not very easy for people to just try and eliminate me. And so, I mean, I was able to hold my ground. I had my friendships, my alliances, and fight back.
And in 2004, Tehelka bounced back.
We did that, actually. But, you know, that itself was a great challenge, because even though everybody admired us and some maybe loved us, everyone was terrified of being formally associated with us, because nobody wanted the state's ire on their back. So nobody would back us with any kind of money or investment, you know. But Tehelka had become almost universally well-known in India. Everybody knew about it. And finally, I traveled for 9 months up and down India in 2003, trying to raise money to resurrect Tehelka. And I did that by addressing groups of citizens. And any friend of mine who would set up a meeting of 5 people, 10 people, 500 people, I would go there and I would address them. I would remind them of what we had done and what had happened to us. It was public knowledge. And I would just ask them to be good citizens and back the return of Tehelka with an advance subscription, nothing more. And my point being, we would come back and we would do more of the work, but the citizens had to step forward and help us. And it's extraordinary. I think close to 12 or 13,000 citizens actually wrote up advance subscription checks for a news magazine that may never have come. We raised just about enough to bring out the first two issues of the new magazine. I hired a new team because the whole old team was completely disbanded long ago. I had a new team, and the new team was actually 5 times as good as the old one, because by now we were so famous and iconic, the best journalists wanted to work for us. So we hired a great new team. But by the time I finished hiring a team and set up a new office, there was only enough money left for 2 weeks of producing two magazines, one issue, two issue. I just held my nerve, which I'd learned to do over the bad years, which, you know, one of the things I mastered. I just held my nerve and I said, we'll go ahead and launch it. And in the way the universe will smile on you benignly every now and then, just 5 days before I was to launch the first edition, and I had only enough money for two editions, first week and second week, this young couple walked into my office. They'd written to my sister who works with me, saying they really admired me and the work we'd done. And they walked into my office and they took a small investment, 5% of the company, and they gave us enough money to last 5 months. And that's how it's gone on, by just going on finding money. So almost 50% of my job in Tehelka is raising resources to do the journalism we do. Having said that, I don't have a moment's regret, because the mountain of work Tehelka has done in the last 8 years on most of the crucial issues in India is extraordinary. I mean, Tehelka's journalists have just been at the cutting edge of discourse, have been at the absolute front end of shaping policy by the work they do, and nothing can be more gratifying for a journalist or an editor than to have helped create a publication that does that every week.
So originally was Tehelka a print?
No, you know, we started as as India's first serious online journalism adventure. In 2000, we started as it was called Tehelka.com. We were actually the first serious journalism venture online, and we became very, very famous because of the work we did, including a very big story on match fixing in cricket, which had global sort of resonance. So it was really on the work that we, and we also had a great literary site. The best Indian writers used to write for us. So it was a strange mix, and which is what I'd always wanted. It was the kind of journalistic animal that excited me. It was very high-end and refined and cerebral at one end, and it had the ability to jump into the gutter to clean it up at the other end, you know. So, I mean, that's the kind of journalism that excites me, you know, which is not so highbrow that it loses its abilities to dirty its hands, you know. So that's the kind of, I like my guys in the gutter, but with their heads in Joyce and Eliot, you know, and that works for me.
Can you paint us a picture of what media in India is like?
Well, it's actually very, very energetic. You know, it's fairly free. It's very energetic. And there's a lot of it, which is a good thing. It's really the, a lot of it is also co-opted by political parties and corporate houses and so on. But Indians are very, very news focused. So this, then we have probably close to 100 news channels national of all, in all languages. And we have dozens of newspapers and magazines. And all of that is good because it ensures the plurality of media ensures that it's impossible for anybody, any political party, or any corporate house to fundamentally monopolize all of Indian media because there's so much of it. And that's a good thing. Yeah. So a lot of good work gets done. And it's multi-language, you know. I mean, English being just one of the dominant languages, there are at least two dozen other major languages which have very robust media operations with millions and millions of viewers and readers.
And is Tehelka in English?
In English, it was launched in English, which is my only working language. I mean, it's primarily, it was launched in English. But in the last year and a half, we brought out a Hindi edition. And it's extraordinary. The Hindi edition is already outselling the English. So there are two editions, the English and the Hindi. Both closely connected, but with independent operations, journalistic operations.
And I was surprised to hear from you before we started that there's in India, there's no news on the radio.
That's a real failing because, you know, I've always believed that the most democratic medium of all the mediums that are mass mediums is actually radio because the cost of entry into radio is the lowest. You know, if you want to start a television channel or a newspaper, you need hundreds of millions of dollars. But, you know, in the radio, you can go into the million or two and you can start it. So it's a mystery for me why the Indian state has actually not legalized news radio in India. I mean, if they were to do it, I think we would take the Tehelka into news radio straight away. Because and this argument is a very valid argument because what you do when you don't allow democratic media to flourish is you leave the entire space of media to large corporate houses. So the only kind of persons who can actually enter the space of media today are very, very large corporate houses with deep pockets, you know, because it costs hundreds of millions to launch either a channel or a newspaper or a magazine.
Yeah, I think some of your content would be great on radio because don't you do a lot of hidden camera work with your investigation.
That's right, you know, and also we have a very strong connect with the scholar, writer, thinker class of India. So I mean, it would also give us a chance to put a lot of important ideas out into the public domain through conversations, interviews, you know, which I think would really work in India. I think it's needed because television falls prey very quickly to the need for spectacle. You know, so it's a dilution of content on television is very fast. And newspapers are not everyone's cup of tea. So radio in that sense, if you could get serious discourse going out there on radio, I think it would have a huge impact.
Can you tell us about democracy in India, the world's largest democracy?
You know, it's really complex, Indian democracy. It's a miracle that 1.2 billion people divided across dozens of fault lines still manage to maintain a healthy, functional electoral democracy. It's an extraordinary thing. But having said that, it's plagued by a lot of crises. So there are a lot of internal crises that we face. There is a run on resource. We have 2% of the world's landmass, but 17% of the world's population. So there's a run on land, water, energy, everything. So the challenges are huge. For a politician working in India, balances several dozen conflicting interests on a daily basis, you know. So it's a huge challenge. The triumph of Indian democracy is actually the triumph of the founding vision. The founding fathers of India are probably the most extraordinary group of men or women that have ever existed. You know, Gandhi, Nehru, Ambedkar. These men shaped a kind of idea of a modern liberal democratic republic. Using extremely poor material at that time. You know, when we became independent in 1947, we were 90% illiterate. We had no manufacturing. We were coming out of more than 200 years of colonial rule. Our growth rates were less than 1%. We've been feudal for almost 600-700 years. I mean, the fact that the founding fathers took this material and decided that this country would then enter modernity overnight, it's extraordinary. You know, and to have then, and they did several very important things right in the beginning. And one of them was they gave universal adult suffrage. They gave an equal vote to everybody, man and woman, irrespective of education, wealth, background, nothing. So they, that one, in one sweep, the whole subcontinent became egalitarian because everybody had the same weight of vote. They enacted very important and radical land reforms. They broke down the old feudal structure by putting land ceiling, breaking down large holdings. Between 1947 and 1957, in the first 10 years of the founding of India, what we call the idea of India, they argued and wrote down such important documents and created such important institutions, all of which were constructed to create a liberal, fair, tolerant society, all of which were written and constructed to uplift the poorest of the poor, you know, every single document. That it's that original founding vision, which is so idealistic, which is so all-encompassing and inclusive, that has ensured that we remain the kind of vibrant democracy we do. And so for us, and at the heart of that vision lay the simple idea of the social contract. I mean, all these great men came from very, very privileged backgrounds, and all of them turned their back on their privilege to serve the larger good. So in the very founding of India is this clear notion of the social contract, that if you have privilege, you have to give back. I said this recently at a meeting in Oxford. I said, you know, India was created on the anvil of great selflessness. Today it's consumed by selfishness. It's a problem. We have to refine that kind of mean. I mean, I'm all for the economic efflorescence that has come to us. It's great, the cars, the planes, the wealth. It's all great, that's fine, we need that. But we can't just focus on that and forget the fact that we have 600-700 million people who are still scrounging for two meals a day. So there has to be a kind of sensitization among the elite that all decision-making that takes place in India has to at all times keep within its viewfinder the deprived of India. That all of it must in some way work to uplift the deprived. And a lot of that has happened in the last 60 years. I mean, the fortunes of the Dalits, for example, the untouchables who were really brutalized and oppressed by upper caste Hindus for almost half a millennia. And there are 200 million of them, by the way. They're, things have changed for them in all kinds of ways. So all the seeds that the founding fathers put into the ground have borne fruit in all kinds of ways. But it also means that many of the seeds that have sprouted have also brought conflict with them. And that conflict is coming out of the fact that there is a constant move towards becoming a more egalitarian society. And so conflict occurs. But that conflict is seen with the greatest alarm by the elite of India, because it begins to question and encroach upon their entitlements. But that's okay, because that's exactly what the founding fathers intended, that we do become a more equitous and egalitarian society.
Just over a minute left. So do people have the means for change within India, within the political system, or is it more of a grassroots?
Yes,
from the
it's
up?
In fact the political system that's enabling the grassroots to sprout and grow. And, you know, in the story of My Assassins, actually, any intelligent reader will be able to gauge how the kind of the politics that I've been talking to you about, you know, about the underclass, about the privileged, about the elite, you know, and about the complexity of a country the size of a continent, you know. I mean, we have twice the number of people Europe or Africa has just in India, you know. So the complexities of this journey, and also the fact that I believe that the Indian journey is crucial to the rest of the world, and why the world needs to read about it and know, is because it is in a sense a template for how the rest of the world will be. All of the world will become a melting pot one day, and we will all have to learn to live with varying cultures and ethnicities and languages within the same spaces we occupy. India is the ultimate experiment of that. I think if we succeed, it's good news for the world.
All right. Well, with that, we're fortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.